Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Meet the Expert. I am Elliot Callen, your host, president of Prosperity Financial Group. Very exciting program today. We're talking about health and wealth surrounding the pandemic. We are very blessed today to have Dr. Bill Lloyd with us all the way from Texas. Welcome, Bill.
Hello, Elliot, and hello, everybody.
Great. Let me give you a little bio, and we're going to talk about the coronavirus. And I was just telling Bill offline, I'm getting my second Pfizer shot later this week. And we'll see what kind of reactions I've seen. I've heard of people getting fevers and getting nothing, both all extremes of it. And I'd love for you to explain why some people who get these shots get fevers. My sister-in-law had a 102 fever for 2 days, and other people just have a sore arm, why that happens. But that's another question. So look, Dr. Bill Lloyd is a board-certified surgeon and pathologist and serves as health director for Transamerica Advanced Markets. He is an award-winning medical educator and prolific author. Dr. Lloyd has extensive experience in health communications, online content development, and medical broadcasting. At Transamerica, Dr. Lloyd leads the Wealth and Health Initiative through expert content creation, along with live presentations to financial professionals and the lay public. That's you, the lay public. Today, Bill is going to help us connect with the dots when it comes to health, wealth, and health as it relates to our clients and relates to the general public. So let me welcome you again, Bill.
Thank you, Elliot. Yes, I'm here in North Texas. I'm in Frisco, Texas, for all you cowboy haters. We're about 30 miles north of Dallas, where 2 weeks ago it was -4 degrees. We had no electricity, no heat, no water. But today it'll be 75 and sunny, and I've got the gardeners pulling out the dead shrubs already.
That's great. So, Bill, why don't you give us kind of an update on what's going on with the whole pandemic situation, both in the U.S. and globally? And I know we're all making progress because the vaccine's coming out, but bring us up to date, please.
Sure. We're coming up on our first anniversary of hosting these webinar events here at Transamerica. And we're at a point now where we're joyful compared to some of the news we shared just months ago. If we look at the status of the pandemic right now, there have been 115 million confirmed infections of COVID-19 worldwide, and about 2.6 million deaths reported. Here in the United States, we're at about 27 million infections and about 520,000 deaths. Now, remember, infections doesn't necessarily mean illness. In fact, we now know that over half the people that acquired the virus never coughed, never sneezed, never had a fever, never got sick. So an important distinction in this novel coronavirus, they called it for a reason. It's not like any other coronavirus we've seen before, is how easy it is to contract the virus, but how few actually get very, very ill. So that's all good news there. I also want to touch on hospitalization, because 5 weeks ago, there were close to 120,000 Americans in hospital beds. And right now, that number is getting close to a third of that. That trend is down now to about 46,000 nationwide. So again, more and more good news as far as the communicability of the virus, and it's the sense in 48 of 50 states, 14 days, cases down, deaths down, that people have a very strong feeling that we're turning the curve on this pandemic.
That's great. That is just great. So we live in California. There's a very different attitude here than there is in Texas where you live. You're closer to Florida in their attitude, and we're closer to New York and New Jersey in their attitude. There seems to be a consistent divergent point of views between these states. Is somebody right and somebody wrong?
Well, the United States is a federation. It's a federated republic of 50 states. And the way it works in a national health crisis is the federal government provides resources, but each of those individual states decide the public health measures they're going to impose on their own people. So yes, as you've heard in the news yesterday, the governor of Texas announced a week from now, they're going to lift the mandatory mask restrictions and they're going to open every business 100%. It's worth noting, Texas was one of the very first states that shut down back in March. And a lot of people think the problem, there was such a rush for so many states to shut down when the virus hadn't gotten there yet. So by early May, they opened the doors again here in Texas, but the virus didn't come here till around the 4th of July. And then we had a very long, difficult summer. So it's all about timing. It's all about timing. Different forces at play in the state of Texas versus California. In Texas, with a few exceptions, the schools have been continuously open, but the families have always had the option to keep their kids home if they choose to and learn via the computer. All right. Florida, another different story where they never fully embraced a shutdown of any kind. We're late to the game in enforcing public masking. Now, in addition to the new changes coming to Texas next Wednesday, the governor also stated if there is a change to the 7 and 14 day rates of new cases, then he's going to slap those restrictions back on again. He says he's going to keep his finger on the trigger the whole time. So he's warning people, we're going to take away the mandatory element, but if you want to enjoy life as it is, you better play the game. And so my wife and I were out yesterday to pick up my grandson from school and take him to a little league practice. And there, everybody was still wearing masks and essentially playing the game. But at the same time, the stores are open. And next week, all the restaurants will be 100%. Every business, tattoo parlors, whatever, vaping studios, whatever you want, you'll be able to do it here in the state of Texas. And the businesses have the prerogative to enforce masking on their businesses, within their businesses, if they so choose. So there's lots of details. You hear about relaxing in Texas, but it's not a free-for-all, and it's going to continue to be closely monitored.
So, Bill, we're talking about, you know, health, and in this case, we're talking about aggregate health in a big state or multiple states. How much of this has to do with the opening because of economics and helping small business people out versus the health of the people, or are they, you know, tied at the hip?
Sure. But it's a national priority. We cannot let the economy fail. And yes, it does involve compromise because we are weighing the health of our citizens versus the prosperity of the entire society. And no one has shown by altering what happens in business affects the infection rate and certainly not the mortality rate. So it sounds brutal to say this, but a strong philosophy in Texas is we're going to burn through this. And yes, sad, people who choose not to follow the guidelines may get infected. They may get hospitalized. They may die. But they would have anyway, even if we shut the stores down. So The approach here is we are aware of the risks, but we think the risks of keeping things shut down are even greater and even more holistic, more than public health, but our well-being, our economy. There are strong statistics that say that shutdown communities suffer far more. The death rates don't change much, but there's many more other forms of death and enormous economic insecurity that comes with those shutdowns. And so if someone's going to try to do a balancing equation, they have to include more than death rates. What is the impact to all of society if we shut everything down to protect us from a virus that's going to come anyway?
Well, I heard an interesting statistic yesterday, which brings us to another question about schools for a moment. And I know schools are just, some of them are open voluntarily across the country. Many of them are closed, California, New York. They're just simply closed or they're going to one day a week. We have a new president that's talking about the goal is in his first 100 days that schools will be open a maximum of one day a week that's considered open. And then there's an argument about the teachers union, again, the economics of it, that they're the largest donor. They were some of the largest donors to the Biden administration and even Gavin Newsom. They're the largest donors to the not recall Gavin Newsom program here. So there's a lot of money. And, you know, politics is about follow the money. So what I read about scientifically, if there's no, correct me if I'm wrong, please, There's no reason to not have schools open. If they can't get it right somehow 5 days a week, somehow, or part-time, some more than a few hours a day, but they're just not doing it. What's the science of opening schools? And at the same time, because I run a charity that deals with teenage stress and depression called A Brighter Day, there's a greater chance, from what I've heard, of a child committing suicide, teen committing suicide, than there is of dying of COVID now. I don't know. I don't know if that's an accurate number. I heard that yesterday. What's real here?
There certainly has been a spike in teenage attempted suicides and successful suicides, and a spike in emergency room visits related to drug abuse. So there are some of the added dangers that come with strictly enforcing a pandemic lockdown, whether or not it makes sense or not. Young children crave to be social. They crave to interact. And you can't do it all on Facebook. Yes, the schools have been open here in Texas. Over a month ago, the CDC said all schools should now be open all the time, discussion over. How you go about doing it will be up to you. Now, in my grandchildren's school, they're in a grade school. They've broken them down into pods within classrooms, and that if there is a positive, a child gets sick. And that's the only way they find out in the schools, because they're not testing the children. Right. But child has a fever and stays home and the parents take them to get a COVID test and is positive. Well, then that pod goes home for 10 days, but not the whole class. And they've been able to keep the schools open that way. And there's been no increase in the number of COVID cases among children in Texas when they weigh those that are school at home versus those that are attending school live. So I think people have come to believe the science that we know that children can contract the virus, they can spread it to their grandparents, but very few children actually contract active disease with symptoms, and an extraordinary small number of them suffer from the disease. Right? We're talking less than a fraction of a percent. And so that, again, that's part of the equation. In return for giving children the education they need and the socialization, because there's so much more involved in school than spelling and math and geography. It's social interaction. It's discipline. It's athletics. It's social skills, how to negotiate, how to fight, etc. And they're losing that. Take a 9-year-old boy who's in third grade, and you strip him away of that third grade experience by having him stay home looking at a computer all day. That child is crippled. It's like this child someday becoming a driver and never went to driving school. He just showed up with a license he got in the computer and started driving by himself. Important events in that third grader's life now are gone and gone forever. Yes, they will try to compensate in the fourth grade, but there's already a different agenda for the fourth grade. So I think, again, just like the politicians are saying, the economic needs right now outweigh the social damage, the public health concerns for a small percentage of people. Same story academically. The intellectual vigor of our next generation could be at risk if we don't get them back to school. And don't forget the colleges. Same story there. Now we're dealing with young adults who ought to be able to know the rules and play by the rules. And their parents are paying an awful lot for tuition to have the child staying at home looking at a computer.
Well, let me switch gears for a moment, talking about the fear from the mutations. Because even if we have these mutations, it's possible that we're going to have to get a booster. So now we're continuing with shots. I can't get on an airplane without maybe one day having the right card that says I got my shots. Is the mutation now going to be the next step? And then after that, it's going to be SARS again or some other COVID-20 instead of COVID-19. And are we just going to be having this discussion a year from now, 2 years from now?
Complex questions already. The novel coronavirus, the pandemic, was a unique event. It's the kind of thing that happens on average 3 times a century. Now they're talking about, well, it could happen more often now because of international travel, et cetera. Well, in response to that, what we learned from COVID-19 and apply going forward may actually delay the onset of some future pandemic, right? So that's an important thing to sweep off the table there. COVID-19 right now is a pandemic. The disease is not endemic like the usual cold, like the seasonal flu. It comes back and visits us every single year. The novel coronavirus is a one-time hit. We still have the ability to defeat it if we achieve herd immunity before there's a mutation that changes the total structure of this virus. When we hear about the mutations now, these changes to the genetic information in that virus occur in an area that is very inert, that is not involved in how the disease starts or how the body reacts to the disease. Those are core mechanisms. Viruses are extremely well preserved, and Mother Nature would never let that happen. No, these mutations you hear so much about are happening on the fringe of the virus particle. And I liken it to a license plate, a license plate. You know, when somebody steals a car, what's one of the first things they do? They take the plate off and put somebody else's plate on that car. Why do they do that? So when the cops are running around looking for the stolen car, they don't recognize the new plates and they go right by it. Yeah, virus mutations do the same thing. They change their identity in a small little strip of genetic information that's far away from the core mechanism of the virus. Now, the immune system is looking for that license plate. And if it's changed, well, then there's a risk the body won't recognize it and someone could get sick again, a second time from the same infection. Yeah, but if you're immune to it, you won't fool them very often. It's like putting a replacement license plate on with scotch tape. You drive down the road, it's going to fall off. So in order to protect ourselves going forward and to keep this from becoming an endemic disease, it's important that we do our best with the social distancing and the masks and the hand washing, plus getting everybody immunized as soon as possible. Once 92, 93% of Americans are immune, either because they've already had COVID or they've had the vaccines, then the virus will not have any place to go. There has to be within a community a certain percentage of uninfected people in order for that virus to transfer efficiently. You start taking those people out of the community, they're no longer vulnerable. The virus has no place to go and will disappear and be gone forever. There's still time, and it's a strong reason for everybody to get vaccinated. As we know now about the mutations, there's been no documentation that there's been any alteration to the efficacy of the current vaccine portfolio against novel coronavirus with or without the mutations. What we're learning is it appears that some of these mutations are more efficient at spreading the disease to others, making infected people more contagious to other people and increasing the odds of them getting the infection, but it doesn't necessarily alter whether or not they'll get sick. So right now, the mutations are pretty much nonsensical and that they will not interfere with the delivery of the vaccine and the establishment of immunity against it. But if we wait too long and a more serious mutation arises, then yes, there'll be greater calls for booster vaccines, which you've already heard about. So let's touch for a second on that comment you made earlier. After the second shot, some people, oh, I'm wiped out, I'm a mess. And other people are, hey, my arm's a little sore, but I'm good. That speaks to the individual's immune response to that repeated dose of the novel coronavirus antigen. Antigen, the small fragment of genetic material, the license plate, if you will, that the body uses to recognize that the novel coronavirus is present. That's what that means. Now, for someone who went in for their second shot and got a powerful response, extreme fatigue, achiness, fever, cold, they feel like they're getting the flu. Well, it's very likely then that they were naive to the virus when they got their first shot. They got their first shot, their body built immunity, and wham, along comes the virus, and the body is armed to the teeth, ready to fight it. And these people go down for just 24 hours usually. Other people who sail through it very likely were exposed to the virus and never knew it. It's not a certainty. They may have been exposed to another coronavirus, not the novel coronavirus. You know, every cold is a coronavirus. There's lots of coronaviruses out there. And because of that, your body already had a level of immunity that you didn't know about. You took your first shot, which boosted that immunity. And the second shot didn't have a big effect. So from a clinical perspective, it doesn't matter. What matters is you got that second shot. Even though we know with both Moderna and Pfizer, one shot 2 weeks out, oh, you're over 90%, 93% immune with that. And many people believe that we may just go to a strategy of one shot to accelerate our ability to get as many people vaccinated as soon as possible. Given the option, take the two shots.
All right, well, along that one-shot line again, two-shot line again, if I had an option with Johnson & Johnson now online with a single dose, single shot, and I understand that they're manufactured in very different ways. Johnson & Johnson, I believe, correct me again, uses proteins to to attach to the to the serum, whatever's in there. And then the Moderna and the Pfizer have a brand new technology for the most part, which I think, and I'd like to ask you, will it change the way these are invented in the future because of the RNA use?
Sure.
Wouldn't I want to choose as a consumer just one shot? Give me the dose with the one. I don't want the two.
Right. Well, from a common sense perspective, having one shot is good. Now, the data right now only says one shot with Johnson & Johnson is about 65% effective, which is okay as long as everybody else is at least 65% effective. The gold standard for a vaccine is only 50%. So if you got access to it and it's the only one that's there, then go ahead and get it. If you have a chance to get 95% efficiency, yeah, I would push for that as well. The Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines rely on novel technology. That's right, like novel coronavirus. We use that same technology for an Ebola vaccine in which we just use a small strip of genetic material. These are vaccines that are produced on a computer desktop. Right? There's no eggs, there's no formaldehyde, there's no mercury. It's a small strip of genetic information, hundreds of thousands of copies of it. And that's all the body needs. It gets a whiff of that. That strip of information actually comes from one of the little spikes that you see in those illustrations of a coronavirus. And your body is primed against that little strip of information. And when it comes around again through exposure to the disease, your body is already locked and loaded and ready to fight it and protect your cells from becoming infected. Johnson & Johnson uses a vector approach. So they're using a small strip of virus that they've attached to another inert coronavirus. So they're actually giving you a coronavirus with a bonus piece of COVID-19 on it to achieve the same effect. It builds neutralizing antibodies so quickly to such a high degree that lasts for so long that they've discovered that just one shot is enough. And about that 62% number, just like we learned, 6 months after the clinical trials, Pfizer, Moderna, one shot may be enough. We didn't know that information during the clinical trials, did we? We put it out in front of millions of people and, oh, wow, check it out. Now that we're actually using it, look what we found. I expect we're going to get even better data from Johnson & Johnson, and it wouldn't surprise me if that number jumped to 75 or 80% with just one shot.
Bill, how come no one dies of the flu or a common cold anymore?
Oh, not true. Every year in America, 65,000 Americans still die from influenza, the common seasonal flu that we are supposed to be getting our flu shots for. And I appreciate you bringing that point up. We are still in flu season. People are still getting the flu. True. Not as much as last year or previous years because everybody's aware of social distancing and personal protection. Good. That's a good point. But the flu shot is out there right now. It is still a risk, particularly for folks over 60 or people with chronic health conditions. It works. And it's free. So you don't need to get on a wait list. You can go over to Walgreens today and get that flu shot. So I encourage everybody to have the flu shot. And when the time is right for you, go ahead and get your COVID-19 shot as well.
And so what? And then let me kind of sum this up here, if I could, a little bit here. And that is, what do we look like in the next year or two? And are we ever going to be back to normal?
Great question. I believe we're talking about two different endpoints here. Two different endpoints. The first one, I'll call it a sense of normalcy. So people stop wearing their masks. They start going to restaurants, going to baseball games. And to them, life goes on as it is. We actually think it's going to happen sooner than not. It's by Mother's Day weekend, a lot of America is going to be back to normal. How do we know this? Because Americans have not been tracking the number of new cases or the number of hospitalizations or the number of immunizations. Americans and their behavior have been tracking COVID deaths. And you don't die from COVID unless you get into the hospital. So it all comes back to hospitalizations. And hospitalizations right now are down two-thirds from its peak. People know we're getting ahead of this disease right now, and hopefully it'll stay that way and the numbers will continue to drop. But what's driving society's interest in the endpoint is the number of deaths. And they're dropping now. We're down to 1,600 deaths a day, when at one time it was close to 6,000 deaths a day. That's very good news. And you can mark your calendar. By Mother's Day weekend, in many parts of this country, people are going to start thinking it's normal again. The other endpoint is that herd immunity that we talked about. When maybe 93% of America is no longer vulnerable to the COVID-19 virus, whether because they already had COVID and got over it, or they completed the series of vaccines, either way, they're immune. If you're immune, you can't get the disease. Let's go out and get something to eat. Most people think we'll reach that on paper. They talk about Labor Day weekend, but even the White House is now saying it could be sooner than that. So those are the two real endpoints. You hear a lot of people, including President Biden, saying, well, we'll still be wearing a mask a year from today. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. One thing I've learned is the more things change, the more things stay the same. And it would not surprise me to learn that people slip back to bad habits as soon as things go back to normal. Let's hope they don't. Let's hope everyone has learned the lessons from this pandemic and we can apply those lessons going forward.
One last question. And can I, even though I will have had two shots, can I be a carrier and get somebody else sick?
14 days after your second shot, you will not have COVID in your body. And so it would be impossible for you to give the disease to somebody else. How about a month out? You're fully immunized. Is there any way you could contract COVID and make enough of it in your body to give it to somebody else? All right, that to make you highly infectious. If you're a healthy person with a good immune system, the science says no. The second shot's the knockout. And the virus, even though it got into your body, even if somebody came up to you with a nasal syringe and squirted a fluid full of virus into your nose, your body would immediately recognize it and take action to protect you from it. The virus would disappear and you would not be at risk of giving it to anybody else.
Well, this has been great, Bill. We've been talking with Dr. Bill Lloyd. He's been great. He works for Transamerica. He is the Transamerica doctor on health and wealth. You've been great. And I want to thank you very much.
It's always fun, Elliot. And I look forward to being out there in San Ramon sometime soon to meet with all of your clients in person.
Great. And if you're a wine guy, I'll invite you to come join us for a great bottle of wine. We've got 1,000 bottles at my house.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Enough for everybody. Did you hear that? There'll be enough for everybody.
There you go. And bring your friends and family. We've been talking with Bill Lloyd, and this has been Meet the Expert, and we'll see you again real soon. Thank you.